Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. We've got quite the show for you this week, covering eight really interesting cases that run the gamut of immigration law. We tackle constitutional equal protection issues, admissions, CIMTs, gangs, and you guessed it, antique firearms, just to name a few. With this ragtag group of topics, we're going to just go in circuit order this week, starting with the Attorney General's decision, which surprisingly is not so bad. Also, last week, a fellow member of the Buzzsprout podcast community named Bill Crocker asked me to be on his very interesting show called Rethinking Podcast. We talked a bit about me, the state of immigration in America, and even open borders. It was a great experience and it was a lot of fun. Thanks, Bill. So check out Rethinking Podcast. We'll also have the interview up in the Immigration Review podcast feed in the coming days, so keep an eye out. Now, on to the first case. First up is matter of OFAS, published by the Attorney General on July 14th. This case is about what constitutes government action for purposes of the Convention Against Torture, or CAT. The Attorney General vacated a decision issued by the BIA in this same case last year, and it's actually kind of good for non-citizens. Here it is. To obtain CAT protection, an individual must fear torture committed by a country's government, its officials, or committed with the acquiescence or consent of an official acting in an official capacity. The non-citizen in this case was severely assaulted in his home country by individuals wearing police uniforms. The IJ denied his CAT application and the BIA dismissed his appeal last year, stating, among other things, that even if the assailants were police officers, the non-citizen didn't qualify for CAT protection because the assailants were rogue police officers acting outside the scope of their official duty as police officers. The Attorney General, wait for it, disagreed. Take it in, because another decision good for non-citizens might not happen again under the Trump administration. Here, the Attorney General affirmed that the quote, under color of law framework is the only framework that governs the CAT inquiry. Under the under color of law framework, an assailant acts under color of law, quote, when the actor misuses power possessed by virtue of law and made possible only because the actor was clothed with the authority of law, end quote. And note, the word clothed is not to be taken literally. The focus is on the interplay between the power the assailant wields against the victim and the assailant's connection to the state. In issuing this holding, the Attorney General vacated the BIA's, quote, rogue official test, which had excluded the torture of state actors such as police if the actors were merely corrupt and acting beyond the scope of their official duties. To quote, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, Attorney General Barr, quote, when police officers inflict torture, it is irrelevant whether the police were rogue in the sense of not serving the interests of the entire government or not, end quote. The Attorney General also made clear that there is no legal distinction between a fear of torture from low-level officials versus high-level officials. So I might have just read too many cases this week, but it seems to me that Attorney General Barr just issued a decision that's kind of good for non-citizens. Listeners, please check immediately to make sure that your pet pigs are not flying. Here's a final note. For those of you wondering why it is that the Attorney General himself is issuing a precedential decision vacating a BIA decision, The reason is that the BIA is an administrative agency, and it's considered merely the voice of the Attorney General, who under the law has the authority to issue binding immigration decisions and to vacate BIA decisions. Simply put, if the Attorney General disagrees with a BIA decision, the Attorney General can vacate it and say, no, that's not what I would have said here, and here's why. That's what happened in this case. A very strange framework, and one not often used until the Trump administration took full advantage of it. Might a future president from another political party soon do the same? I sure hope so, if we are to restore some balance back into the immigration system. And that is the Attorney General's decision in matter of OFAS. Sticking with the agency, we've got a BIA decision published on July 14th as well, matter of MDCV. This case is about the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, statutory and regulatory definitions, and even asylum. At 17 pages single-spaced with 18 footnotes filled with dense, and quite frankly ends-oriented, statutory analysis, taking the time to read this case has got me questioning my decision to start this podcast. Here we go. Although the issue in this case is purely legal, here are the facts very briefly to provide some context on what's going on at the southern border. The non-citizen in this case is an asylum seeker from El Salvador. She entered the U.S. unlawfully and thereafter requested asylum. Pursuant to the MPP program, DHS served her with an NTA and returned her to Mexico to await her hearing without an attorney. On the day of her second hearing a few weeks later, she appeared at the port of entry and was brought before an immigration judge. Without an attorney, she testified and her asylum application was denied. She was then returned to Mexico. The entire MPP program is happening because the Trump administration willed it, and the Supreme Court took the extraordinary action to stay enforcement of a preliminary injunction that would have stopped the MPP program last year. Here's the legal background. Under the Immigration and Nationality Act, and pursuant to new Trump administration policy, certain non-citizens, quote, arriving on land, end quote, into the United States can be returned to Mexico to await their removal proceedings under the MPP. This includes what's known as an applicant for admission under immigration law. The term applicant for admission is an amorphous term that we don't really have time to get into at the moment. Now, the non-citizen in this case was deemed an applicant for admission. She claimed on appeal, however, that the term, quote, arriving on land, as required to trigger the MPP Remain in Mexico policy, should only apply to those non-citizens classified as, quote, arriving aliens, a specific term under immigration law with a specific legal definition. Without getting too deep into it, the non-citizen in this case arguably doesn't meet the definition of an arriving alien because she was apprehended within the United States rather than at a port of entry trying to come in. The BIA rejected the argument, and again, without getting too deep into the weeds, held that the term arriving for MPP purposes, quote, encompasses an alien like the respondent who is apprehended 20 yards north of the southern border and not at a port of entry on the same day she crossed into the United States, end quote. The BIA didn't give DHS a blank check, however, and in a footnote, left to another day whether non-citizens, quote, apprehended well within the interior of the United States, end quote, could be subject to the MPP and sent to Mexico to await their removal hearings. Hopefully, the Supreme Court answers that question before the BIA. And that's basically the main holding of a very complicated 17-page case. Here are some observations, mainly for immigration practitioners. First, to reach its conclusion, the BIA kind of concedes that it's using different definitions, or at least fluid definitions, for the term arriving alien. Even though the term is specifically defined at 8 CFR 1001Q. But as I've mentioned before on the podcast, the Supreme Court and the circuit courts don't like it when the BIA defines the same term in the INA differently, so stay tuned. Relatedly, the BIA's decision is a cautiously written one, based largely on its determination that the governing regulations are ambiguous, therefore conveniently allowing the BIA to fill in this ambiguous gap. But if recent circuit decisions applying the Kaiser and Orr deference standard are any indication, the BIA is right to be cautious. The circuits don't seem to want to defer to the BIA when the BIA is interpreting its own regulations, and the Supreme Court in Kaiser has given the circuits a green light to reject the BIA's regulatory interpretation. Next, and for what it's worth, the BIA punted on whether the non-citizen in these proceedings was properly classified as an arriving alien, because the BIA said it didn't matter in this case. So at least this decision does not stand for the proposition that individuals present without inspection or admission can, at DHS's complete discretion, be classified as arriving aliens. And finally, the BIA yet again avoided addressing constitutional challenges or statutory challenges to the MPP. But I don't know how it rejected the right to counsel claims in this case with a straight face. The BIA flat out stated that non-citizens returned to Mexico or who, quote, face practical impediments to obtaining counsel, including being in detention or lacking financial resources, whether or not detained, do not alone constitute a due process violation, end quote. Maybe so, but it comes pretty darn close. Indeed, the BIA's multi-page analysis of why the pro se non-citizen failed to provide sufficient evidence and legal argument to obtain asylum, in the humble opinion of one podcast host, in and of itself shows how important it is to have an attorney in immigration proceedings. And that is a matter of MDCV. Next, we turn to the Second Circuit with Milan Hernandez v. Barr, published on July 13, 2020. This case is about motions to suppress, a fun aspect of immigration law that we haven't yet discussed on the podcast. Buckle up for some constitutional analysis, listeners. Unlike in state or federal courts, in immigration court, the federal rules of evidence don't apply. All that stuff about Miranda warnings and throwing out the admissions of a defendant doesn't really apply in immigration court. However, immigration court hearings must still be, quote, fundamentally fair. And nearly four decades ago, a plurality of the Supreme Court said that, quote, an egregious constitutional violation may make immigration proceedings fundamentally unfair and require the exclusion of evidence obtained through an egregious constitutional violation. What qualifies as a, quote, egregious constitutional violation differs throughout the circuits, but most, if not all, agree that state action based on race or another improper consideration will constitute an egregious violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And so, if a document DHS tries to submit in immigration court is shown to have been obtained following an egregious constitutional violation, it should be excluded, just like in criminal court. And if the unconstitutional documents are the only evidence that DHS has to establish a non-citizen's removability, removal proceedings should be terminated and the non-citizen should be allowed to stay in the United States. But before documents are excluded, immigration judges are supposed to have a suppression hearing. If after that hearing, a non-citizen establishes that an egregious constitution violation likely occurred, known as a prima facie showing, then the government has the burden to show otherwise. Okay, so that's Constitutional Immigration Law 101 in 2 minutes. Here's the case at hand. Miss Milan Hernandez was a passenger in a car with other Hispanic individuals that was stopped by New York police in the middle of the night. The police officer suspected that they didn't have lawful status, and so he called DHS. DHS came over an hour later and arrested Miss Milan Hernandez. But here's the thing. The Fourth Amendment bars police from detaining people unless they have at least reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed, and being in the U.S. without authorization is not a criminal offense. As the sworn affidavits submitted on Ms. Milan Hernandez's behalf alleged, the only reason the cops seized Ms. Milan Hernandez is because she was Hispanic. An egregious constitutional violation. To prove to the immigration court that Ms. Milan Hernandez is removable from the U.S., DHS submitted only one piece of evidence, a DHS Form I-213, which is kind of like a DHS police report. So if Ms. Milan Hernandez could get that document suppressed, the case gets terminated. But the IJ held that Ms. Milan Hernandez did not even warrant an evidentiary hearing on this issue, and the BIA agreed. The Second Circuit disagreed and issued two important holdings. First, it held that IJs must consider sworn statements in determining whether a non-citizen meets her initial burden for a suppression hearing. And second, the Second Circuit held that a non-citizen meets her initial burden to get an evidentiary hearing by simply presenting evidence that, quote, could support suppression. And a single affidavit can meet this burden. The non-citizen only then has the burden to make her prima facie case for suppression after the evidentiary hearing itself has occurred. Excellent holding. So, the Second Circuit sent it back to the agency to do the proper analysis. Great case for non-citizens and for the U.S. Constitution. Two quotes bear repeating. First, quote, when a law enforcement officer detains and questions an individual about her immigration status, although she is not suspected of a crime, those circumstances offer a strong suggestion that the search or seizure was improperly based on race, end quote. In other words, any case where a traffic stop lasts longer than would be expected and citizenship is brought up probably provides grounds for a suppression hearing. And second, quote, the inquiry of the passengers regarding their immigration status had no bearing on the reason for the stop and bore a questionable relationship to the local officer's likely authority. Being a Hispanic migrant is not a crime, end quote. Amen. And that is Milan Hernandez v. Barr. Staying with the Second Circuit, we've got Ordóñez Azmen v. Barr, published also on July 13, 2020. This case is about asylum, particular social groups, and the changed country condition exception to the one-year filing requirements for asylum. And it's a doozy. Mr. Ordóñez Azmen is a former member of the Mara 18 gang in Guatemala. He quit the gang and, in fear for his life, fled to the U.S. in 2003. At his merits hearing in 2010, he testified to having known multiple gang members killed by Mara 18 for deserting, one even during the pendency of his asylum application. The IJ denied Mr. Ordóñez Azmen's asylum claim as untimely because he hadn't filed it within 1 year of coming to the U.S., as required to apply for asylum. The one-year bar, however, can be excused if country conditions have changed materially as it relates to the applicant's claim. The thinking goes, if conditions in a non-citizen's country weren't so bad when he arrived in the U.S., but after a year got really bad, that individual should be able to apply for asylum, notwithstanding the one-year requirement. The IJ also denied Mr. Ordóñez Azmen's request for withholding of removal, which does not have a one-year time limitation. To deny, the IJ relied on BIA precedent that former gang members who resist recruitment do not qualify as a particular social group. And membership in a particular social group, as listeners will recall, is one of the five protected grounds required to get asylum or withholding of removal. The BIA affirmed the IJ's decision, but the Second Circuit sent it back to the BIA for further particular social group analysis, and to consider whether changed circumstances that occur after the asylum application is filed, but before a decision is rendered, as occurred in this case, can excuse the one-year bar. Back before the BIA, Mr. Ordóñez Azmen submitted 200 pages of additional evidence and asked the BIA to remand his case back to the IJ, because the BIA isn't allowed to review new evidence. The BIA denied the motion and denied Mr. Ordóñez Azmen's claims again. Specifically, holding that only evidence that predates an asylum application can excuse the one-year filing deadline. And that Mr. Ordonez Asman's particular social group of former gang members was not particular and was too similar to the group it had previously rejected in its precedential decision, Matter of WGR, which relates to gang recruitment in El Salvador. Mr. Ordozman Asman again took his case to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit reversed the BIA's decision again and made some good law for non-citizens along the way. First, addressing particular social groups. The Second Circuit held that the BIA did not conduct the proper analysis for particularity, one of the three elements required to establish a PSG. It reasoned that because the analysis is case and country specific, the BIA can't just reject former Guatemalan gang members because it had already rejected former Salvadoran gang members in Matter of WGR. So practitioners take note. Former gang members can still be a valid PSG under asylum law. Excellent news for asylum seekers. And the second holding is even better, and it's this. Materially changed country conditions that arise while an untimely asylum application is pending will excuse the one-year filing deadline and will therefore make an otherwise untimely asylum application timely. How about that? In the court's own words, quote, "An adequate showing of changed circumstances materially affecting eligibility is all that the words of the statute require to excuse untimeliness and to permit the agency to consider the application," end quote. Here, Mr. Ordonez Asman testified that a former gang member he knew was murdered in Guatemala in 2010 while his asylum application was pending. This constituted changed country conditions that materially affected his asylum application, and the IJ should therefore have considered Mr. Ordonez Asman's untimely asylum claims. Great case for non-citizens. Here are two observations. First, in reaching its holding regarding the changed country conditions exception to the one-year filing deadline, the Second Circuit states that the unambiguous, quote, "statutory language plainly ties changed circumstances to the agency's power to consider an otherwise untimely application, not to the applicant's ability to file the application," end quote. This quote is important because the Trump administration seems to be trying to direct IJs to deny asylum applications as quickly as possible and without even holding a merits hearing, if, among other things, the application is filed beyond the one-year deadline. But as this case and this quote shows, changed country conditions can arise at any time, so to terminate an asylum application before the final hearing would, to me, improperly focus on the, quote, "applicant's ability to file the application," and constitute a flat-out due process violation that contradicts the unambiguous statutory text. Or so a practitioner may argue on appeal. And finally, it's worth noting that when it remanded the case back to the BIA the first time, the Second Circuit asked the BIA to address the changed country condition exception in a published decision, but the BIA declined to do so. So word to the wise, BIA, this is what happens when you don't do what the circuits respectfully request. And that is Ordonez Asman v. Barr. Finishing up with a very active week for the Second Circuit, we've got Jack et al. V. Barr, published on July 16, 2020. It must be the month for antique firearms, because we've got another one, and it's a good one. The non-citizens in this case, both lawful permanent residents, were convicted of New York Penal Code 265.03, criminal possession or attempted criminal possession of a firearm, and 265.11, criminal sale of a firearm. They were found removable by the IJ and the BIA under INA Section 237A1C for having been convicted of a firearms offense, and in the case of one of the non-citizens, for having been convicted of a firearm trafficking aggravated felony, as defined at INA Section 101A43C. The Second Circuit said, "Take that, rewind it back. These convictions don't match the definition of a firearms offense. And why not? Because New York criminalizes use of an antique firearm, while, as we know, the federal firearm definition does not. To reach its decision, the court relied heavily on its recent decision in Williams v. Barr, discussed on the podcast almost 2 months ago, involving the realistic probability test and a Connecticut firearm statute. Like Connecticut, the New York firearm statutes don't exclude antique firearms. And as the Second Circuit held in Williams, where the state statute is clearly broader than the federal removability offense, here, because New York clearly doesn't exclude antique firearms and the federal offense does, the realistic probability test has no role to play. The non-citizens don't need to find a case where New York actually criminalizes use of an antique firearm, because the statutory text is clear on the issue. Antique firearms are technically criminalized, and that's the end of the story. The analysis is over, and the non-citizens get to keep their green cards. Great case for non-citizens and the strange world of firearms offenses. I simply have two observations. First, to reiterate, following this decision and Williams v. Barr, it may very well be the case that no firearms crime in Connecticut or New York will make a non-citizen removable under the firearm grounds of removability. Second Circuit practitioners would know better than I, but it certainly appears this is the case, because it appears that both states do not exclude antique firearms in any of their firearm definitions. And finally, I simply must quote the Second Circuit's statement that, quote, "The BIA applied the wrong legal standard and displayed a fundamental misunderstanding of the categorical approach," end quote. Indeed they did, Second Circuit. Indeed they did. And that is Jack et al. V. Barr. Moving on to the Fourth Circuit, we've got Nunez-Vasquez v. Barr, published on July 13th, 2020. This case is all about CIMTs, or crimes involving moral turpitude. Mr. Nunez-Vasquez was present in the U.S. without authorization. In removal proceedings, he applied for non-LPR cancellation of removal, which, among other things, required that he show that he was continuously present in the U.S. for at least 10 years, and that his removal would cause exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to his U.S. citizen or LPR parent, spouse, or child. However, a non-citizen is ineligible for non-LPR cancellation if they've been convicted of a CIMT. Here, the IJ, and then the BIA, in what appears to be a fairly lazy decision, found that Mr. Nunez-Vasquez was ineligible for non-LPR cancellation because he had been convicted of not one, but two CIMTs. Leaving the scene of an accident in violation of Virginia Code 46.2-894, and use of false identification in violation of Virginia Code 18.2-186.3(b)(1). The Fourth Circuit held that neither conviction was a CIMT, and here's why. First, as we've discussed before, the court applied the categorical approach, as it must, comparing the elements of a CIMT to the elements of the criminal statute. Generally speaking, a CIMT requires, quote, two essential elements, a culpable mental state and reprehensible conduct, end quote. Conducting the categorical analysis in this case, the Fourth Circuit held that first, the use of false identification conviction is not a CIMT because the statute does not require an intent to deceive the government or obstruct a government function, which is what normally is required for a crime like identity theft to qualify as a CIMT. It also is not morally reprehensible, as it can be committed by using a completely made-up name, like Mickey Mouse, and a completely made-up identity, rather than an actual person's identity. As to the leaving the scene conviction, without more, such a conviction doesn't qualify as a CIMT. Now, the crime in this case does require more, Namely, it requires injury to the other vehicle's occupants or property. But the Fourth Circuit held that the statute doesn't require that the defendant have actual knowledge that an injury has occurred before he or she leaves the scene. It requires only the lesser mental state of mere criminal negligence. And criminal negligence is not usually enough, and might never be enough, and certainly isn't enough in this case, for a crime to qualify as a CIMT. So, Mr. Nunez-Vasquez is eligible for cancellation of removal. And because ICE has already removed Mr. Nunez-Vasquez to Mexico, they need to, quote, facilitate his return to the United States. Love me some good CIMT crimmigration. Here's some even better stuff. First, in reaching its conclusion on the identity theft statute, the Fourth Circuit agreed with the Ninth Circuit's 2014 decision in Ibarra-Hernandez, where the Ninth similarly held that a statute that allows for the use of a completely fictitious identity, rather than a real person's identity, is not morally turpitudinous. This is kind of a big deal, because I'm willing to bet that almost all false identification crimes allow for conviction where a completely fake name, rather than an actual person's identity, is used. And now we have two circuits saying that this won't cut it for a CIMT. And indeed, the Fourth Circuit goes even broader in a footnote, stating that for such crimes to qualify as a CIMT, quote, in addition to deception, there must be harm to others, which can include obstructing an important government function. Thus, the use of a false identification on its own is not enough to find that a crime involves moral turpitude. Sing it, Fourth Circuit. An excellent quote to combat DHS and Oil every time they argue that a conviction is a CIMT simply because it has some element of fraud or deceit. And that is Nunez-Vasquez v. Barr. Turning next to the Seventh Circuit, we have Escobedo Marquez, published on July 13, 2020. This is another case about asylum, specifically whether a woman who identifies as a lesbian from Mexico suffered persecution or had a well-founded fear of persecution. Miss Escobedo Marquez is from a small conservative town in Mexico and identifies as a lesbian. She was in a secret relationship with a woman for 2 years. But then began receiving violent text messages, social media posts, and threats in the mail against her due to her relationship. But there's some evidence that these threats were coming from a jealous ex-girlfriend. She changed her phone and notified the police. She also presented evidence that her daughter from a previous relationship attempted suicide in Mexico due to bullying she had received in school. Ms. Escobedo Marquez's partner, also from Mexico, testified at the immigration court hearing about the threats, and about threats that she herself had received elsewhere in Mexico, and about discrimination and harm against LGBTQ individuals in Mexico. The IJ and the BIA found that her evidence did not show that she suffered harm that rises to the severe level required for persecution, or that Ms. Escobedo Marquez had a well-founded fear of future persecution in Mexico. As we've discussed before, non-citizens have a high burden to get a circuit court to overturn the IJ and the BIA's factual findings. And here, the Seventh Circuit said that Ms. Escobedo Marquez didn't meet that burden. It held that the threats she received weren't sufficiently severe or immediate, and that the evidence doesn't show that there exists a pattern or practice of persecution against LGBTQ individuals in Mexico. So, a short decision ruling against the non-citizen. But here are three decent things for asylum seekers. First, the Seventh Circuit did confirm its prior precedent, consistent with other circuits, that threats alone can constitute past persecution. It just held that the threats in this case weren't sufficiently, quote, immediate or menacing in nature, end quote. If, for example, there had been evidence that, quote, the sender attempted to follow through on the threats, end quote, the Seventh Circuit may have ruled in Ms. Escobedo Marquez's favor. Second, Although the Seventh Circuit held that Ms. Escobedo Marquez's daughter's attempted suicide didn't indicate asylum eligibility, because it wasn't connected to Ms. Escobedo Marquez's LGBTQ identity, the Seventh Circuit does infer that if sufficiently connected to a protected ground, an attempted suicide by an asylum applicant or her family member may establish past persecution or a risk of future persecution. For example, if an applicant is driven to attempted suicide due to threats on account of a protected ground. This is an interesting and somewhat novel argument that, with the right facts, might prove successful. And third, although the Seventh Circuit rejected Ms. Escobedo Marquez's alternatively claimed fear that she would suffer economic persecution, it made clear that economic harm does, quote, constitute persecution when it is deliberately imposed and results in severe deprivation of economic opportunities, end quote. I'll take it. And that is Nunez-Vasquez v. Barr. Rounding out the show this week, we've got Eduardo Rendon, the U.S. Attorney General, published by the 11th Circuit on July 14, 2020. This case is all about cancellation of removal for permanent residents, or LPRs, the stop time rule, and retroactivity. And the petitioner in this case was represented by Anthony Dominguez and friends of the podcast Prada Urizar PLLC. Great win, guys. Mr. Rendon became an LPR in 1991 and was convicted of a CIMT in 1995. But he was only sentenced to 364 days in prison for his conviction, not a full year. In 1995, this conviction didn't make Mr. Rendon removable because he wasn't ordered to at least 1 year imprisonment. But the next year, Congress changed the law, lessening the imprisonment requirement and making Mr. Rendon removable. And a year after that, in 1997, Congress changed the law to make people like Mr. Rendon ineligible for a form of relief called cancellation of removal. 25 years later, DHS tried to remove Mr. Rendon. And here we are. To be eligible for LPR cancellation of removal, a non-citizen must have been continuously present in the U.S. after being admitted in lawful status for at least 7 years. In 1997, however, Congress made it so that the commission of a CIMT and other crimes stopped the 7-year continuous presence clock. This is referred to as the stop time rule. An IJ found Mr. Rendon removable and ineligible for cancellation of removal, finding that he could not meet the 7-year continuous presence requirement because the clock stopped as a result of his CIMT. And the BIA agreed. The 11th Circuit reversed, holding that the stop time rule cannot be applied retroactively to convictions obtained before the implementation of IRA-IRA in 1997. And in so holding, it appears to agree with the 3rd, 4th, 7th, and 9th Circuits, disagrees with the 2nd and 5th Circuit, at least in part, and disagrees with 3 published BIA decisions. Great win and great holding. In the interest of time, I won't get into the excellent retroactivity analysis undertaken by Judge Martin, but it's a must-read for practitioners in the 11th Circuit to review if and when they make their retroactivity arguments, and it rebuts a lot of potential counterarguments that the government might make. Here are 3 select observations. First, practitioners everywhere should make similar arguments in court unless their circuit has already answered the question of retroactivity. Because as the 11th Circuit notes, circuits do not defer to the BIA on the issue of retroactivity. Second, and although not consequential in this case, the stop time statute actually applies when a CIMT or other crime is committed, not when conviction occurs. However, as the court notes in a footnote, in the 11th Circuit at least, the commission of a CIMT only activates the stop time rule when either A, a conviction is obtained, or B, the non-citizen admits to the elements of the crime. At that point, the stop time date is backdated to the date that the crime was committed. In practical terms, this makes it highly unlikely, at least in the 11th Circuit, that a non-citizen will ever effectuate the stop-time rule without a conviction. And finally, in what has become a theme out of the circuits over the last few months, the 11th Circuit also held in this case that the criminal alien bar at INA Section 242A2C did not strip it of jurisdiction to review Mr. Rendon's case because the question presented was a question of law. It's been a great few months out of the Supreme Court and the circuits for jurisdiction. And that is Eduardo Rendon v. U.S. Attorney General. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate for 5 credit hours, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook, at Immigration Review, and send us a tweet, at ImReview, that's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.